Time for Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt is in the house, and excited to hear about this book because you've been raving about it since you started.
Yes, it's called Big Game, Small World, A Basketball Adventure by Alexander Wolf, who many people will remember as one of the big key writers of long-form work at Sports Illustrated. This book was written originally after he traveled the world, and we'll get to that in a minute, in the late 90s, so the book came out in the early 2000s. This is the 20th anniversary edition. It's expanded with some more information. It's one of the most remarkable books I've ever read, because while the lens of this is basketball, it's about global humanity. And he literally traveled the world looking for how basketball is popular in all over the world. In fact, basketball is the game most played in the world.
More than soccer.
By about 20%.
Wow.
And part of the reason is that there are places where, I mean, you can play basketball anywhere. If the weather's good, you play outside. If it's not good, you play inside. Soccer is not a game that you play inside. I mean, there is indoor soccer, but it's not the same thing. And it only takes five guys on a side,
right,
or five women on a side, whoever you're going to play. What he did, Wolf grew up in Princeton, and he went to preschool in Princeton and the like, and then he went away. His family moved away to upstate New York. Excuse me. And then he went to college at Princeton, and he couldn't play there. He wanted to play there, but he couldn't. He knew he was. He was a 145-pound, 6-foot-tall guy, and, you know, Pete Carril was a pretty good coach, and Princeton was doing pretty well and all that. But he did play in Switzerland as a pro, and that got him in this wanderlust to see how things go around the world. And I'm reading this book, and I'm having a great time. I'm visiting Lithuania, I'm visiting Italy, I'm visiting all these places. Then there came a section on Sarajevo, and it brought me right to my knees. When in the summer of 1969, I took the $600 I'd saved from having the newspaper business in prep school, selling the New York Times and the Herald, and some money my parents gave me. I met a friend of mine in France, and he and his brother and I hitchhiked and took trains from there to Istanbul, all through Eastern Europe and Central Europe and parts of Western Europe, and then on to Israel for a while, and then back through Switzerland and home. And while I was on a train in Belgrade, there were four. And this was when there was a Yugoslavia. Tito's Yugoslavia held together. A group of four guys heard us speaking English and wanted an explanation of why in football there's often big pile of people. Why you make this big pile of people? And I suddenly realized the guy was saying pile. And I started to explain football to him. And then he said something about, well, I don't understand why you're so awful to black people in your country. And I said, well, not everybody is. You know, this is 1969 again. We're talking not that far removed from the 68 riots, and a lot of people in Europe, that's what their vision of America was. We start talking about race relations. And this one guy said, you should live in Yugoslavia. Nobody hate nobody here. Everyone, Croat, Serb, it make no difference. Muslim, Bosnian, Catholic, Orthodox, he's going this whole thing. We're one family, believe in one thing. Well, you know, 20 years later, we're in the incipient stages of what becomes one of the most horrifically awful wars in Europe, the Balkan Wars, and the atrocities on all sides are there. It was an unspeakable horror, and if Bill Clinton gets credit for nothing, it should be that was put to an end in his time there. And it reminded me that we can all sort of look at sports as something that we enjoy. We can look at it as something that we think we've learned from or is good for character, whatever. But you look back to the great Yugoslav basketball teams of the late 90s, and they dominated world play. Our pros were not playing so much in those days, and some of these, but they were great. And they were composed of Bosnians, Croats, and Serbs. And they won gold medals, and they won European championships, and they did well in the Olympics. The war came, and guys that had been brothers, and I mean brothers, they would go live in the same place for a month and train and get ready. No longer dared talk to each other because if someone saw them, they'd think that they were collaborating. It talks about people walking 9 miles each way and through a tunnel into Sarajevo to play basketball games to avoid snipers. It's not a bleak book by any means, because a lot of this is very, very positive stuff. The stories of basketball in Italy and are great, but also the story of how James Naismith came up with basketball is a different one than I had ever learned before. And to figure out what was going on, Wolf traveled to Almonte, Ontario, which is where Naismith was from, and learned about a game called Duck on a Rock, where a duck, toy duck, was placed on a big rock, and you had to knock it off with a smaller rock, and how the kids learned to get round rocks and to know what an arc was and to hit it, and that Naismith apparently talked about Duck on a Rock being one of the things that made him think about basketball. Then I also learned, I always thought that the rules, the early rules in women's basketball were a result of something someone had been done here in the United States. But oh, no. A woman who was living in Brazil at the time wrote to Naismith and asked for the rules of basketball. And he wrote the rules down and he sent some diagrams with where players might station themselves. So this woman decided that meant that they had to stay in those places. And that, her name was, I think, Clara Barr. I don't remember exactly now, but that's how it became a big game in Brazil. Because when she codified it that way and tried to show Brazilian men about the game, they said, no, if this is a game for women, we're not playing this game. So for the longest time, Brazil had some pretty good women's teams. Then it sort of faded. And then women's basketball emerged again in the 70s. And 80s as being huge in Brazil, and WNBA stars later on were sort of cajoled into coming down and playing games there or playing for teams. I had no idea that women's basketball in Brazil was a big deal. What this book does is it takes you to places like Bhutan, which is a tiny country for those of you that don't know, that borders Nepal and is stuck right between the two most populous nations on earth, India and China. A country that doesn't want tourism because they don't want to build that kind of infrastructure and ruin their environment. It takes us to France. It takes us to a lot of places. But what it really does is it shows why sports captivate people, what draws people to a game, that the biggest market for NBA gear is China. And he's gone to China a number of times to try and understand. Goes to the Philippines. The NBA is huge in the Philippines. You get in a cab, and the cab driver's got on a Celtics jersey and a Pelicans hat. And that it's because of the the NBA was really smart in the way it marketed itself to the rest of the world. It never, ever in its career didn't want foreign players. I mean, once foreign players became available, the NBA embraced that.
Right.
That is not true of a lot of other teams. I mean, think about how at the beginning, baseball would only take people from Latin countries if they appeared to be pure white, right? There was always keeping people out. It seems like it seems that I'm not I don't follow the NBA closely. I follow college basketball a little bit, but it seems that one of the things that Wolf discovered is how this magic can go places. In fact, he and some friends bought a team started a team called the Vermont Frost Thieves. He lives up in Vermont now, for $10,000 and ran it for 3 years just to see what it was like to run this basketball team. And then you see that some of the people involved in that are now in international places. A fellow who was coaching, I remember whether it's Mike or Pete McCullough. I was coaching in Poland, they weren't getting paid, and he was still coaching, and he didn't want to quit, and his wife was there, and she didn't want him to quit, and eventually he gets fired. He ends up now, he's a commentator, I think, for the, if I remember correctly, for the Timberwolves. But all these people had all these places where they met. And so much of it was meeting overseas. And you don't think of baseball coaches as having gotten their start by coaching overseas. You don't think of football coaches certainly have gotten their start from coaching overseas. Hockey coaches, yeah, well, some of them start out coaching in Europe, but most of them, their coaching begins in North America. And a lot of people who have gone on to coach and work in the NBA got out of college, there weren't any jobs, so they went and they started working in places that you wouldn't imagine. There's a section here about basketball in Africa and how it is so incredibly ramped up in parts of Africa. And then you look and you see how many players of African descent came in and made, you know, the Elijah Wans and like, who made a huge impact on the game. But what I have to say about this book, it is written like a top-notch novelist. The language, and it's clear. It's never self-indulgent. The story of Alexander Wolf trying to get a one-on-one game with the King of Bhutan might be one of the most interesting chapters I've ever read. And I'm not going to tip any of this stuff off because I really hope people read it. And we'll talk to him on the 14th. He's going to join us. But it reminded me as I read this book of the greatest of W.C. Hinds. And you know I hold him in the highest esteem as maybe the greatest American sports writer of all time. It's long form. It's not sound bites. It's not an attempt to tell a story in 2,000 words or less. Each chapter is like 10, 12, maybe 15 pages long. So you don't have to read this book all at once. And if you haven't read it for a week and you pick up at a new chapter, it's a whole new story. So I can't recommend this more, any a book anymore. It's called Big Game, Small World, Basketball Adventure. It's from Duke University Press. I don't remember who did the original, but the expanded version is great. And the introduction and the preface to it are just absolutely fabulous. And a lot of this also takes place in the United States. There are places he goes. There's a chapter on basketball at the Palestra. If you've never had the privilege to see a basketball game at the Palestra, and I saw one there, it's the most intimate. If you think the pit is intimate, the Palestra is insane, and it holds like at least twice as many people. And for years, it was where the Big Five in Philadelphia played.
Right.
And his remarkable story starts with speaking to the custodian, who is at the same time, we don't know this until the end, getting his BA from Penn in American civilization while working as the custodian at age 57. Right. He gets it and spends his time listening to classical music when he's not working on the court. just the best stories found by a great writer.
Yeah, he's so good. I look forward to reading it and look forward to talking with Alex in a couple of weeks.
Yep. And here's the book so you can take it home.
Excellent. I will do that. Thank you much, Bruce. What's coming up next week on Sports Lit?
Next week, what I'm going to do, because we're going to have Alex on the 14th, is I'm going to give my rundown of great books to buy, gift books for this year for the sports fan. I thought if we waited till the 21st, it would be very difficult for people to get them. So
right.
So we'll talk about that next week, and we'll do it by sport, I think. A couple in each
Excellent.
Sport.
Sounds good. Thank you, Bruce.
My pleasure.